This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news and intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversations. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the management and staff of Guardian Radio.
Good evening, Bahamas. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto and my co-host Dr. Wesley Francis, who is a Bahamian surgical oncologist and general surgeon. And we're pleased to have again as our guest Dr. Ian Fernander, who is the longest standing employee of the Central Bank of the Bahamas. He's now retired. He's involved in motivating young persons into getting into business. He also owns his own publishing company, and he's essentially a business guru. Welcome, Dr. Ian Fernander. I know you don't like to use the word doctor, but we're trying to inspire young people to strive for the heights of education. So, Dr. Ian Fernander, welcome again.
Good to be here.
So, today is World Cancer Day, and we are overwhelmed with cancer in our society. We are honored to have, of course, our co-host, who is the cancer expert of the nation and the region and is internationally recognized as a surgical oncologist who's a cancer surgical expert. So we'll delve into his great knowledge base. We were grilling Dr. Fernander the last two times he was on the show. I think today we'll talk, let him be more of the host and ask actually medical questions. We're going to talk a little bit about his medical past and journey, but we want to have a healthier Bahamas.
Absolutely.
Longevity. Better quality of life, and we always stress it's not just a physical. We want to have a better spiritual life, a better emotional life. You can never underplay the toll that so many persons have with hidden psychological stresses, and there's so many ways that we can help them. And the unseen can even be more destructive than the seen, and that even goes for many of the non-communicable diseases that overwhelm our country. Hypertension, diabetes, the list goes on and on. We're one of the most unhealthy countries in the world, one of the most obese countries in the world, and there seems to be no end in sight. But let's talk about your health journey, Dr. Ian Fernander. You are very health conscious now. I know you're a vegetarian, but you weren't always so fortunate.
Yeah, I've been a vegetarian since I was 17. So that's pretty much near five decades of being a vegetarian. But oddly enough, I'm not just a vegetarian, but incredibly active in my younger days, very athletically involved. But one part of my journey was, interestingly enough, I had a cycling accident where I almost lost my leg in that accident. And after recovering or during the recovery period, I found myself, like for a year plus, I couldn't even run. But I found myself immersing myself in work, which I'm a workaholic in the first place, but I really like took it up another level. And also eating a lot. So inactivity and eating. And at some point in that journey, I got to pretty much around 300 pounds. And the wake-up call, I was told by the specialist, you have sleep apnea, you can die in your sleep. Here is this machine called a CPAP machine that you're going to have to sleep with. And I remember the first night trying to put that on, and the moment hit me that I'm not on earth to wear this stuff. And I didn't even put it on the first night, so I'm going to have to find a way to reverse this situation. And I certainly did. And I've been on a mission since to keep myself healthy, and I realized that there are things that young men don't know, because I spent about 12 to 14 years getting to that point without being cognizant that I didn't have to get to that point.
And how much do you weigh now, Dr. Fernando?
210.
Okay. So what was life like for being 300 pounds?
I have, you know what? Hardly noticed it. And because I'm pretty tall, but I look back at my pictures then and say, wow, this is how I looked. But I thought I was okay, except that I started to have sleeping problems and getting tired and being told that I was pre-diabetic and all these other things. But because I was so sedentary and not running up and down like I did when I was younger, I wasn't challenging myself to even find out that I was working with a deficit.
Understood. You mentioned something that's a huge crisis, and it's usually a one that we don't speak enough of, and that's obstructive sleep apnea. And there's so many obese gentlemen in our country, young men, boys, teenagers, that don't even understand what obstructive sleep apnea is. And it's a vicious cycle where if you're obese, you're likely to have obstructive sleep apnea. With the obstructive sleep apnea, you're going to have lower testosterone. You're going to have very disruptive sleep. You're not going to have sufficient deep sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. So you can go to sleep and wake up feeling like a zombie. Your testosterone that you use throughout the day is not being replenished, because that's only replenished when you get REM sleep. So these men get on this cycle of destruction, where all of a sudden they're 40, 50, 70 pounds heavier. They are in a male version of menopause with their low testosterone. They feel a shadow of their former self. They feel inner destruction because they have no more erections. They have no more energy. They have no impetus to do anything. Things they used to love to do, they don't want to do anymore. All they want to do is go home and sleep. It affects them negatively professionally, physically, within their relationships, everything else. And when 70, 80% of our male population are obese, there's a high predominance, maybe 25, 35% of our population have obstructive sleep apnea. And not only is it a nuisance where you're snoring and you stop breathing and your spouse, your loved one, is alarmed that you may have basically stopped existing because you stopped breathing for so long, but it can increase exponentially your risk later in life of a cardiovascular event, a heart attack, or a stroke. It's going to reduce not only the quality of your life, but your longevity on this earth. And on top of that, essentially, you can kill yourself because you're so fatigued. Your testosterone is going to be so low. You're going to feel so tired and fatigued that you can literally fall asleep when you're driving. And I've seen it many times. People have had disastrous consequences where they either lost their life or nearly lost their life or killed somebody else because of obstructive sleep apnea that they didn't even realize was an entity. So when we talk about what we do in our youth, we pay for in our later years, and we talk about World Cancer Day, we want to know, what is it that we can do in our younger years in terms of diet, in terms of our exercise, in terms of what we do and we don't do? Dr. Francis, we always talk about modifiable and non-modifiable risk factors. There are too many, even young persons, who have a cancer history in their family, and they feel doomed from the age of 15, feel doomed from the age of 20, because they see three of their aunts have breast cancer. They see four of their uncles have colon cancer at a relatively young age. But the vast majority of persons, unless you have a strong genetic component, actually can modifiably reduce the risk of getting several cancers. What are some of the modifiable risk factors that persons out there should be aware of to reduce your cancer risk in general?
So what's interesting, if we go back to what Dr. Fernanda had said, you know, he had an accident, and that actually put him in a situation where he became very inactive. So lack of activity, sedentary lifestyle. And with that, the combination of that sedentary lifestyle and consuming food so much, so eating a lot. So a lot of intake, no output. And so you just get into a place where your body is in this uptake phase all the time. What's telling about his story is really the inactivity. And so if you want to understand what is a modifiable risk factor, he modified it by adjusting the activity and also by adjusting the way he ate. So the amount of calories that he took in and the amount of activities or calories that he burned, he improved on. So that in and of itself, and that's a perfect example of what is modifiable. And if you're in a situation where you're consuming a lot and not burning enough, and you're in this uptake phase of a vast amount of insulin and vast amount of and being obese, all of those are risk factors, and all of that stems from a lifestyle. And these chronic activities, this chronic lifestyle and living that way is what then leads to this us developing an environment in our body that predisposes us to developing cancer.
I mean, you've managed more breast cancer cases than anyone, or nearly anyone in the country. So we'll rely on your vast experience in regards to breast cancer. We've spoken about this before in detail, but we would like to reaffirm this knowledge for the women out there. When they reach middle age, what is the risk of being obese or being overweight and its relationship directly to breast cancer?
So definitely in postmenopausal women, and that's where it's most significant, because estrogen has a hormonal influence on the breast and can lead to excess estrogen can lead to development of breast cancer. That's a risk factor. So premenopausal women produce estrogen from their ovaries. Postmenopausal women actually produce estrogen from fat cells. So the more abundant fat cells you have, the more the increased environment of estrogen you have, and then that then increases your risk. So it's really the postmenopausal women that really have to be mindful of creating an environment that's what we call carcinogenic by, you know, having this excess estrogen on board, which they shouldn't have, because the enzyme, what is known as aromatase, changes the fat cells and causes them to produce estrogen. And that's the link right there.
I mean, in our society, a lot of women are retire, even mandatory in some sectors, by 60. And they may live another 30 years or 30 plus years. And in that time, it's fundamentally important that they have exercise, that they watch their diet.
The fundamental thing is inactivity, yeah. Right?
And not only that.
He says it himself, the inactivity.
And mental as well. You need to stimulate yourself mentally, because you can have mental decline that can increase your risk of dementia and Alzheimer's and everything else. So you need to optimize yourself physically and mentally going into retirement. That's very important. You're going to live longer if you have something to strive for, something to get up in the morning to do, something social, et cetera, et cetera. Keep your mind active as well. Dr. Fernando, as you're entering middle age, you're a little bit older than us. What are some of the things that you feel are affecting you and that are inevitable, and a lot of men out there may not be forthcoming in talking about as you've gone from your 40s to your 50s and now in your 60s?
Well, certainly you learn that issues with your prostate, I think the doctors use the word, as you grow older, you're going to inevitably have some issue with your prostate, in particular with its size. But that's one thing, but you can have other issues as well. Oddly enough, when you're younger, you probably don't even know you have a prostate. In your 20s, in your 30s, it's just not a part of your life. So certainly as you get older, this thing that sort of didn't exist before becomes the central part of your life.
That's true.
And you kind of wonder, like, why is this suddenly an important part of my life, and it hasn't been before. Should I? Is there something that I could have been doing in my 20s and in my 30s and in my 40s that would make this less of an issue as I grow old? Although people keep telling you it's inevitable. You kind of say, well, I'm not sure if it's that inevitable, because not 100% of men have problems. So why am I in that percentage?
Well, we have the urologist right
here. Yeah, so unfortunately, it is inevitable. And any urologist in the world, the most common thing that they're going to have to manage in their practice, especially if they have a general practice and they're not super specialized, for example, they only deal with kidney stones or they only deal with bladder cancer, they're like going to have to face prostate issues, and that means benign disease, and that means cancer. So 1 in 6 of our population, men, are going to get cancer of the prostate at one point.
That is huge.
And that is huge. So it is a number one cancer in terms of incidence in our country.
Overall, yes.
Overall, and the number one killer in terms of cancer deaths in our country as well. So it is fundamentally important we understand and that we need to pick up prostate cancer early, because, as I said over and over and over, and this is indisputable, the chance of cure is nearly 100% if you pick up prostate cancer early, but prostate cancer has little to no symptoms until it's too late. So we need to start from the age of 40 with a blood test, PSA, prostate-specific antigen blood test, and we need to take it every year and compare 1 year with the next, all the way until at least 70, and then you can even encourage to do it up until the age of 75. And those who have longevity in your family, you'll even do it until their 80s and their 90s. But unfortunately, there's not a lot that we can do to prevent enlargement of the prostate. We do it by decades, usually 50% of 50-year-olds, 60% of 60-year-olds, and probably 80% of 70-year-olds have somewhat of an obstructing prostate. But we need to differentiate the difference between benign disease and cancer. So there's so many patients that will come to me over and over and say, my general practitioner, my internist, my physician for my whole life told me that my PSA is fine, but why am I peeing 5 or 6 times in the night? Or they did the dreaded digital rectal exam, which I'll get into, really has a little to no value. And they said, my prostate feels relatively small. Why do I have a weak flow? Why does it take almost a minute for me to initiate a stream? Why do I drink something and then within 20 minutes I got to pee again? That shows that they're not understanding what PSA is. PSA looks at the likelihood of the possibility of there being prostate cancer, but PSA is not a very, what we say, sensitive or specific test. It can be elevated for many reasons unrelated to prostate cancer. It's related. The PSA is specific to the gland. It's not related to prostate cancer. So there are other more specific tests, including MRI imaging of your prostate, that we can determine whether someone has prostate cancer. But it's inevitable. In fact, we can't really fully understand why we get BPH. There are 3 leading hypotheses in regards to that. And one is estrogen ratio. The higher estrogen to testosterone ratio in older men may trigger prostate growth. The next one is DHT, which is dihydrotestosterone accumulation hypothesis. So as men age, testosterone levels decrease, but the dihydrotestosterone, which is a potent androgen derived from testosterone, accumulates in the prostate, and this drives cell proliferation within the prostate. So we can understand that because years in the 1600s, men who were castrated, who were going to become monks and were had to be castrated before puberty, and they never developed BPH. That also helps us understand. Then there's the third hypothesis, that it's loss of homeostasis, which is looking at apoptosis and proliferation imbalance. So basically, BPH, benign prostate hyperplasia, is considered a failure to maintain the balance between cell death, which is apoptosis, and cell growth, which is leading to an excess accumulation of the epithelial and stromal cells of the prostate. So those are the main theories behind it. So
let me see if I get you. You're saying, and for the last portion, that your cells are outliving their death, or the dying ones.
Correct.
Are not dying fast enough.
So as you get older, a lot of persons think that your prostate is growing at an accelerated rate. It's not. It's essentially growing at the same rate as you were in your 20s and 30s, but your cell death rate is slowing down. So the cumulative effect is your prostate gets bigger because of decreased rate of cell death, and that's called, cell death is called apoptosis.
So are there any lifestyle or medical things that a man can do to change that scenario, to help themselves, just talking about the cell death, to help that be a bit more balanced than it is?
So your prostate, like any other organ in your body, your heart, your lungs, your eyes, your kidneys, the healthier your lifestyle, the more likely you're going to have a healthier prostate. And as I mentioned earlier, and we said it before, what we do in our youth, we pay for in our later life. If you have sexually transmitted diseases, that can lead to numerous cancers, including increasing your risk of prostate cancer. If you're obese, you have obesity doesn't cause prostate cancer, but it causes a more aggressive form of prostate cancer. So that's something we can do. We can make sure that we don't become obese for many reasons, a myriad of reasons that we can go and speak 10 shows on. You should not be obese. You should not be overweight. We want to, as black men, and we're predominantly of African ancestry, we want to limit our dairy milk intake because of the high levels of hormones, including estrogens, in their dairy milk. And prostate cancer is very hormonal sensitive. We don't want to trigger prostate cancer by increasing our risk of by dairy milk intake. And they've done studies. They've shown that the limit that puts us over the threshold that increases our risk of prostate cancer by maybe even fourfold is 1 3/4 cups of dairy milk. And it's not just dairy milk. It's dairy milk products, cheeses, everything else.
Ice cream,
everything else. So as a black man, as a man in the Bahamas who has a 1 in 6 chance of getting prostate cancer in their lifetime, I would limit my dairy milk intake altogether. I would make sure that I have a normal body mass index. I would reduce my red meat intake, my processed meat food intake, my saturated fat intake. It may seem humorous, but it's true, and you can just look at it from a layman's terms. If you clear the tubes, the less likely you're going to have a buildup of harmful potential carcinogens in your prostate. So studies have shown there's a long-term Harvard study went over 20 years looking at 27,000 participants. They found that 21 ejaculations a month significantly reduced your chance of getting prostate cancer by 25% to 30%. That's something you can do as well. And I think a lot of men like to hear that. And some of them come and see me after I've been on the radio and said it and ask me to write a prescription so they can give it to their girlfriend or their wife. And then they can look, and the science is there. Because obviously, you don't, I always say, and Dr. France will say, Google is not your doctor. But when you look at Google, you can use it almost like an encyclopedia and look at reputable sources. And this is in a reputable medical journal. You can look at it with more credence than, you know what, someone who's trying to sell somebody something because they have a profit they're trying to make. So you can definitely do that. There is a medication. It's called a 5-alpha reductase inhibitor. You know that finasteride is it, can actually not only lower your accumulation of excess prostate cells so you don't get such a big prostate, but it can use to counter male pattern baldness as well. So you can actually take it once a day, keep your hair, and reduce your chance of getting a larger prostate with prostate issues with what we call low urinary tract symptoms, and keep your hair. Plus, it can reduce your chance of getting low-risk prostate cancer by as much as 25%. So there are many things that we can and can't do. Obviously, you don't want to smoke cigarettes. You don't want to
be alcohol.
So a lot of men don't want to hear. Can you talk us a little bit through what came out in January of last year in terms of recommendations in terms of alcohol and its link to cancers.
Well, the Surgeon General in the U.S.
And we're not talking about binge drinking either.
We're talking just regular consumption of alcohol. Consumption of any alcohol actually led to a significant increase at risk in 7 different cancers. I mean, breast, pancreatic, colon, you know, prostate.
Breast
and that's
as
important.
Well.
Yeah, we said, talked about breast. Yeah.
They said, and, I think they remember 15% of breast cancers in the United States were linked to alcohol. 15%.
Linked directly to alcohol. And, so, you know, a lot of these studies don't, have a direct link. But, I mean, this was the one study that actually showed a direct link to alcohol. I mean, when you standardize everything and you can see the direct link to alcohol. And so it's become... a change in recommendation, really. I mean, one time we used to say moderation, right? You can say, you know, drink maybe 1 or 2 cups or glasses a week or so. But now it's no alcohol because of the risk, and that risk was brought forward by the Surgeon General, and that really was a game changer. I think it speaks to the, you know, that's another lifestyle issue. And we talk about modifiable risk factors that we taught. That is a modifiable risk factor.
Well, the Bahamas is in trouble because we are fun-loving people, and alcohol is central to that. It's really central to how people define fun in this country.
It's interesting that the things that we think bring us joy and happiness are also things that in the long term actually reduces our lives, right? Again, the food that we have, the excess food, the inactivity, the alcohol consumption, the tobacco use. And I mean, I think really the inactivity is significant because our lives are set up in such a way that it's so sedentary. We drive everywhere, right? We don't walk anywhere anymore. We drive. We go home. We sit on the couch. We watch TV. We have a remote. We don't get up and go to change anymore. It's so set up that we have, unless we are deliberate and intentional about our choices, then, you know, it's almost like as if it's a passive development or predisposition to develop these cancers. And, you know, it's chronic lifestyle changes that, you know, if we're not intentional about what we do. And again, your story, when we started off, you had to be intentional. And the trigger for you was the CPAP machine. Every one of us at some point have to have a trigger. And that would then force us to make the right decisions to change our lives.
And some things sneak up on you, you know. For instance, if you're a professional, you can be, like I was, working 12-plus hours
a day. I'm a workaholic just like you.
Working weekends and not realizing the impact that is having on everything else.
Because absolutely.
It's in that scenario where you're eating all the time, where you're not sleeping, you're really, especially if you have a job. Some professions have jobs where they're moving. But there are other professionals, like I was in banking, where you're really not doing that much movement. You're sitting in an office.
Sitting at a desk.
And you're going in on the weekends and sitting in an office and just sitting. And to really, you tell yourself to keep yourself going, you've got to keep eating.
But it's more complicated than that. You can always preach to society that they need to be active, and we have to look at where our society is at this moment. I can remember 3 distinct conversations I had with patients, and obviously I'm speaking in generalities, but I asked a patient why they stopped exercising, and they said, you know what, I used to walk all the time with a group, and on one occasion, 2 young men pulled up in ski mask with gun pointing at us, and we never walked again.
Yeah.
Another one said they used to go 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30 in the morning, they used to go swim in a group, and they said they came out of the water one day, again, held up. Our society has become so dangerous. Another one said that they went walking, and when they came home with the wife and 2 kids, the house had been broken in because someone was watching to see if wait for them to leave. So it's a very complex situation.
And I can tell you, I cycled. I will not do it today after my accident. It is such a dangerous thing to jump on a bicycle in this country, because you don't know what you're going to meet with the way people drive, the fact that so many people are not in their right mind and don't pay attention and don't have courtesy. You could get hurt. So sensible people, I used to ride everywhere. I don't jump on a bike anymore.
And I mean, like, if you were riding your bike and someone knocked you down and they were drunk and killed you, what are you going to get? A $2,000 fine? I don't understand the rules of our court, where in many respects we don't respect somebody's life. If someone runs you over versus someone shoots you, why is someone getting a fine versus someone getting a jail sentence? The same life is taken, and you'll never live that life again. So let's talk a little bit about more what this unhealthy bohemian society, Dr. Francis. What does diet have to do with colon cancer? And we're overwhelmed with colon cancer as well.
Well, so colon cancer is the number three cancer in the country. So overall, I would say prostate, then next breast, and then third is colon. So that's overall. And for male and females, it is the second most highest incidence, right? Colon cancer has a significant relationship to diet. And so if you consume high fat content and high, especially animal protein, meat, if you compare, and then there are a number of studies out there that compare people who have a plant-based diet versus people who have an animal fat diet or meat diet, then you know their risk of cancer, of colon cancer, is much higher. Unlike
and
the
fiber?
Other cancers, and also fiber.
I mean,
the colon it needs fiber for proper functioning, and not only for colon cancer, but then you also get diverticulitis, which is another benign condition of the colon when you have lack of fiber. But what's important is that unlike breast and prostate, where we can't really prevent those cancers, we try to early detect them. Colon cancer is totally preventable, because it starts out by changes in the lining or the mucosa of the colon, and you develop what is called a polyp. And then that polyp then, over time, and it's projected somewhere between 8 and 10 years, that before that become what we call neoplastic or cancerous. So you have a significant time or lead time under which you, if you can detect a polyp and remove it, you can actually prevent colon cancer. Unlike with breasts, you screen to early detect. For prostate, you screen again to early detect. For colon, you screen to prevent. And I think that's is something that people need to be aware of. And what's the screen? The screening tool is the gold standard is really a colonoscopy. And
which
that should be done at age 45.
Diagnostic and therapeutic.
Right. Diagnostic and therapeutic. I mean, there's also a virtual colonoscopy, which is basically a CT scan of your colon, and that is more diagnostic. But a optical colonoscopy, that's more diagnostic, meaning it identifies the polyps, and you're able to remove the polyps. So that's why it's called diagnostic and therapeutic.
And the colonoscopy, you have conscious sedation. So the vast majority of persons are not even going to be aware that anything happened.
The worst part about the colonoscopy is the prep. And you got to go through that. You got to sit near the toilet. And after that, you don't even remember. I had my colonoscopy, and I don't even remember what happened. I just, I got the IV, and then I woke up, and like, what happened? Yeah. Right?
So do you doctors think that at some point in the evolution of medicine that prostate would fall into the category where you're able to diagnose and prevent? Do you think that's even possible?
It is. There are a lot of interesting research going on, is even looking at certain bacteria that can predispose you, bacteria that you find in your prostate that can predispose you to getting prostate cancer in later life. There are the whole management and with screening and for cancer is growing by leaps and bounds. It's almost becoming like science fiction. We've spoken about this in the past. Liquid biopsies, Dr. Francis, where essentially, if, for example, for breast cancer, you may need 500,000 cells to clump together to form a lump that could be palpated, or even 200,000 cells, cancer cells, to form something that can be seen on mammogram or even on MRI. But if we use liquid biopsies, and there's a FDA-approved Galleri test where we're looking at DNA fragments, so we're talking years before these cells accumulate, we can put persons in certain categories that you're at very high risk of getting colon cancer in the next 3 years. You're at a very high risk of getting breast cancer in the next 5 years. So we'll talk more about that science fiction, which is a reality in terms of DNA fragment testing and liquid biopsies for cancer prevention and screening on the other end of the break. This is Urologist Week.
TG Music Fest. Janae Aiko. Ludacris. Ashanti. Nelly. Glorilla. LMA. Maya. Joe. D Nice and Friends. Featuring SWV. Donnell Jones. Case. Sunshine Anderson and Kenny Burns. The Isley Brothers. L. DeBarge. Stephanie Mills. And so many more. March 7th and 8th. Hard Rock Stadium. Tickets and info at jazzinthegardens.com. Jazzinthegardens.com.
Get ready for the biggest football game of the year, Super Bowl 60. We have the best seat in the house for you. Join Star 106.5 All-Star Team live at Anthony's on Paradise Island on Super Bowl Sunday, February 8th, from 2 to 6 p.m. Enjoy giant screens, delicious fun food, ice-cold Kalig Bear specials, prizes and surprises nonstop. It's the place to be for Super Bowl Sunday. Anthony's on Paradise Island. Watch the Patriots take on the Seahawks.
Seahawks!
The Star 106.5 All-Star Team will be there to cheer you on from 2 to 6 p.m. It's the biggest Sunday of the year for the biggest game of the year, Super Bowl 60, live at Anthony's on Paradise Island. Don't miss it.
Always on the go? Miss the show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere, on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back. This is Urologist Speaks with Bahamian Urologist Dr. Gregory Pinto, my co-host, surgical oncologist Bahamian Dr. Wesley Francis, and Dr. Ian Fernandez is here again. We're talking about men's health. We're talking about living a healthier lifestyle, longevity, improving our quality of life. We were talking about the overwhelming predominance of numerous cancers in our society. We're talking a little bit more about liquid biopsies. There's an FDA-approved test called Galleri. Can you talk to us about liquid biopsies in terms of screening, in terms of surveillance after someone has been, quote-unquote, successfully treated for a cancer? And this is very important. For example, there is no real screening tool for pancreatic cancer, which is deadly.
Most pancreatic
cancers will only have symptoms when it's stage 3 and stage 4, and it's inevitable that you're not going to live.
So the whole principle is based on what we call circulating tumor DNA. So as their tumors exist within the body, it sheds its DNA within the blood. And if you're able to pick this up, then you can see how you can early detect or even use it as a monitoring tool after treatment, treatment monitoring. And so there's a company, I think the name of the company called Grail, and that brought out this same test that you talk about, Galleri, that can detect these different circulating tumors, DNA that is within the body, and be able to give you sort of a predictive score to say, you know, whether what your risk of cancer would be, and therefore it would then individualize your screening. So let's say, for example, you take the test and the test says, hey, you know, you have a 50-60% risk of pancreatic cancer, then you can then individually screen for that. We don't really have a screening test for pancreatic cancer, and so it's helpful in that way. For colon cancer, for example, you know, if it is that you have surgery, and then after surgery, then you can screen people using a test like that also to see whether they have what is known as molecular residual disease. So if you have molecular residual disease, then those people would need further therapy, for example, like chemotherapy. If not, then, you know, you could spare that person from getting any more aggressive therapy. Aggressive therapy is not necessary for everyone. And so these tools, or these new tools, are now helping better select people, select for individual screening, and select for more individualized or precision medicine in terms of therapeutics. So that's the whole idea. And also, for tumors that you can't readily biopsy, we need, you know, if you have a breast lump, you can get a tissue biopsy. If you have your prostate, you can get a tissue biopsy. But there's other areas in the body that you can't readily get a tissue biopsy. But if it is that you can find the circulating tumor DNA within the body that correlates to those tumors, then this is why it's called a liquid biopsy. Mm-hmm. And it's really a game changer, and it's made medicine more precision guided. Precision from a screening perspective, precision from a treatment monitoring perspective, and predictive in terms of, you know, what your outcomes are gonna be.
Okay. Now I have two questions, one for each of the doctors. The question for Dr. Pinto is to do with ejaculations, and the question for you is to do with immunity. In terms of ejaculation, you mentioned that there seemed to be some risk with not having enough ejaculations per month. So my question there, and there's also a risk, obviously, in having STDs and having infections in that area.
So we're not advocating sweethearting to save your prostate, no.
So my question is, does it matter how one gets their ejaculation? You mentioned sweethearting, but does it matter?
Does Pamela matter?
It doesn't matter by any means necessary, but obviously we advocate something which is what we call group participation, two persons. The reason for that is we open up another topic that is not spoken of enough, and that is because of the information age and everything's at our fingertips and our cell phones and our iPads, something called porn-induced erectile dysfunction. So using imaging, videos, et cetera, as a form of leading to ejaculation can actually essentially rewire your stimulation center and your pleasure center, and that it'll be more difficult for you to get an erection and sustain an erection with an individual, with a female, if you have a predominance in your daily routine or a weekly routine.
And there's some people who rely a bit on drugs and alcohol.
Correct.
Marijuana,
correct.
Other yes. drugs and yes. alcohol.
Yes.
And Red Bull and whatever else that's out there. Is that okay?
No. So we open up another Pandora's box, and that's the use of unregulated, I won't even use medication because they're not formulated as medication. They're not marketed as supplements, because then they don't have to go through human trials or FDA or receive FDA approval. So I always say your gas station cashier is not your pharmacist and is not your physician. So all of these things that you say, oh, this is rock hard or this and that, may have an active ingredient of what we call PDE5 inhibitors, which are the Viagras, the Levitras, the Cialis. But they are made cheaply because it's a $1 billion business. And you look at many of them have sawdust in it. They have lead paint chips in it. They're marketed as cheaply as possible to get as much profit as possible, and you take it at your own risk. And when we talk about erectile dysfunction, obviously you want to get your confidence back. You want to get back on the saddle. You want to get those erections back, particularly for a Bahamian man, because that's part of his identity and his self-esteem. But we want to treat the root cause. If the root cause of your erection problems is because you have onset of diabetes, we need to treat the diabetes. If it's because of uncontrolled blood pressure, which is a silent killer, the first thing is going to kill is your erections, we need to treat the hypertension. Yes, we'll give you that regulated medication to get your erections back on track, but we need to treat the root cause, and that's what we need to do in all of medicine. So you borrowing even your cousin's Viagra can be deadly to you because you don't know what other medications you're taking that interact, and that's not solving the problem. Too many men will take it upon themselves because of embarrassment, and no one should be embarrassed because everybody has an issue with erectile dysfunction at one point or other in their life. But by the time they take something that was never prescribed for them or just to treat the symptom, 2 or 3 years later, that diabetes has already done untold harm to the blood supply to their male member, the nerve supply to the male member. It's affected their eyes. It's affected their heart. Irreversible damage to their kidneys. Erectile dysfunction can be an early sign of something more sinister going on, and that can prevent you from getting a heart attack or a stroke many years down the road. Good evening. We have a call coming. This is Urologist Speaks.
Good afternoon to all of my, I should say, mentor that I listen to.
Thank you for the kind words. Good evening. Good afternoon.
Yes, I thank you. If our man could only understand and just listen to this show and just learn.
Well, if we can change one person's life, it's worth our time.
Yes. There's a saying, when in my discussion I deal with male also, that a healthy ejaculation helps a man with his prostate. Am I right on that?
Yes, it can significantly reduce your chance of prostate cancer by as much as 25% to 30%.
And I heard one of your guests, or I think you alluded to the sweethearting, right?
Yes, I think a lot of persons will say, you know what, you're not going to kill me with the responsibility of 21 ejaculations a month. You must be advocating that my husband gets 2 extra sweethearts to help me out. And that's not the point at all.
So the man is being beat up always by accused of being having a sweetheart. But in the Bible, you can see no way in the Bible where a man was warned. I mean, a woman was warned of keeping a sweetheart, but you see where a man was warned to look out for one for the woman who sweethearts. But having said that, how do a man now supposed to function holding this over his head when this group of feminists now is trying to promote and introduce the law of marital rape? Now, I'm not encouraging abuse in no which form, and I think I don't support it in no which way. But how can a man function normal when marital rape is over his head? Would that have an effect on him getting an erection?
I'll leave that for Dr. Ian Fernandez.
Yeah, that's
wow. I'm wondering why you're leaving that for me. Well, I'm not sure that I see the connection between the whole debate around marital rape and
assault is assault.
Yeah,
assault is assault.
I'm not sure that I see it. One is that the consternation about about marital rape. It seems to me that in this country, that has been sort of put on the sidelines. I'm not sure why we're still talking about it, because I believe the political class seem to have ditched the whole matter. But certainly, just the word marriage and rape doesn't go together. I'm not sure why we even want to put those two words together for as a married man, I can say that.
I think it's more complicated. I don't want to get into this controversial topic, there are, let's even say someone is separated, they're legally married, they haven't had any relationship for 5 years, that means that he can just go bang down the door because, quote-unquote, the divorce has been delayed for 5 years and assault
but even a strange wife? Whether in or out of marriage, I would say no man should want to be comfortable with the idea that he is forcing a woman to have sex with him.
Correct.
Period.
Correct.
I don't care whether you're in marriage or out of marriage or whatever. Why would you want to have lovemaking include force? And why would you want to, even there by force, I mean, why would you even want to have a relationship with someone who doesn't know that you're having relationships with them, like a drunk woman or a high woman? What's with that? What does that say about you as a man if that's okay? I certainly want the other person to understand and know what's going on and agree with it. And any other thing to me is not normal.
Yeah, I think we'll leave that topic and put it to bed. So let's talk about a scenario, Dr. Francis, as a cancer expert, and I'm sure it takes a toll on you to see cancer patients day in and day out, and some of them are stage four, and their outlook on life is not a very positive one, despite all the armament and tools that you have in medicine to try to save them. But let's say that there's actually a vaccine that can prevent a virus that can eradicate 94% of a certain cancer.
Could I put in my question in here as well?
Yes,
it's kind of associated with yours. I wanted to know if there's a link between the health of your immune system and dealing with cancer.
I mean, absolutely.
Gut health. Talk about the gut health
because vaccination, a part of what vaccination is it gives you a certain immunity.
Right.
I was getting into that is 94% of cervical cancers can be eradicated by HPV vaccine. Right.
So I mean, the immune system is God's defense. I mean, your body's defense, right? And it defends against microbes or anything invading. And obviously, cancer cells, Dr. Pinto had mentioned about apoptosis. And apoptosis is what we call failure of cell death. And so your immune system also rids the body of cells that are dying. And if they fail to die, the immune system recognizes them as foreign and also can prevent cancer in that way. I mean, this all happens at a molecular level that we don't see, but all of that is happening in the immune system. The immune system is important in prevention, in treatment. And nowadays, in fact, immunotherapy is a game changer and is a hope for many women, for example, with triple negative breast cancer. One time ago, triple negative breast cancer, and again, breast cancer could be hormonal associated or not. And those that are not hormonal associated is what we call triple negative breast cancers that tend to be very, very aggressive and tend to affect more younger women. And, you know, prior to having immunotherapy, it used to be a cancer that was devastating, very poor prognosis. But now, with the advent of immunotherapy, we're seeing cures, right? From something that was a death sentence to something now that with medication alone, you've seen the tumors actually disappear. So much so that the guidelines for treating triple negative breast cancer has changed dramatically, that surgery is not the upfront therapy or the first line of therapy. You should get medication first and then afterwards get surgery. So the immune system is very important as it relates to any, it's cancer care, also with microbes. Viruses can produce cancer.
So could you tell the man on the street what he has to do to have a good immune system? Or is it some of the stuff you already talked about?
It is exactly some stuff that we all said. If you don't poison your body, then your body obviously would have, because this is built in, okay? I mean, there are some diseases that actually affect the immune system itself. And we all know that, like certain viruses affect and wipe out your immune system. HIV, hepatitis, those what we call retroviral diseases, they affect the immune system. But the immune system, healthy lifestyle and avoiding toxins and avoiding alcohol, avoiding tobacco, activity, all of these things promote, a healthy immune system overall.
Can we give a little synopsis? What exactly is immunotherapy? Let's not make the assumption that the public understands what immunotherapy is.
Immunotherapy is varied, right? It's where really the medication that is given allows your own native immune system to then fight the cancer in different ways. So for your immune system to work, you really need to be able to identify what the offending agent is or what the cancer is. And sometimes cancers evade. And then also the cells, or what we call the cytotoxic cells, also they then have to be able to recognize cancers and to be able to kill them. So the immunotherapy sort of boosts all of that. And so it allows your own native immune system to then fight and kill cancers, and also helps in better recognition. So that's kind of the basic sort of principle of immune system of immunotherapy. It boosts your own natural body's defense system. So it's almost as giving you reinforcements rather than regular chemotherapy that actually goes in there and is cytotoxic, that kills the cancer and also kills your own immune system. It's sort of it boosts your natural your body's natural ability to kill, in essence.
When we talk about what's eroding our country, that we are such an unhealthy nation, a lot of that has to do with our young men and are becoming wavered. They don't have any future in sight. Many of them live with not even thinking about the consequences of tomorrow. So you can ask them to stop eating the fast food, go to the gym, eat healthy, put down that cigar, stop drinking alcohol. And they say, you know what, I'm trying to live till next week. I'm 20 years old. I have two jobs. I got two children for two women I shouldn't have had those children for. My life is so hectic. I'm just trying to make it. And this whole abstract thought of eating right, exercising, eating healthy, everything else, I'm just trying to live to the next day. What do you say to those persons, Dr. Fernando?
Well, life is stressful for almost everyone, not just the men you talked about, but even for men who are in stable relationships and marriage and just who have their heads on their shoulders. Life is stressful. I think what we as men have to look at is developing a sense of commitment to our own survival. And I don't know that enough of us have that. And when you develop a sense of commitment to your own survival, it really means that you are committed to contributing to yourself, contributing to your family, contributing to your community, contributing to the world. And you realize that in order for you to do that, you have to be good. You have to be in good condition.
And you got to be there.
And you got to be there. And I think if more of us can just focus on that one thing, how do I find a place where I can be committed to contribution and I can find contentment in my existence, then I think more of us will move away from, hey, this thing is harmful to me, therefore it's harmful to anything I can be. And we do need to be able to get that message to young men, not even when they're in their 20s, but way younger, to understand that, hey, you've got to take care of yourself so that you can take care of everything else.
I mean, obesity in this country starts at 6 years old, starts at 8 years old. It doesn't start in their later teens or 20s. What we do when we're younger, obese children become obese, teenagers who become obese, young men who become obese, middle-aged men. We have a call coming in. Good evening. This is Urologist Speaks.
Yes, good evening, Dr. Pinto. Is that Dr. Curling? Francis Curling?
Dr. Francis.
Yeah,
Wesley Francis.
I was running the steps.
Yes.
And my radio went dead. I was trying to hurry up, come in to catch you guys, but initially I caught the show when the radio, when your voice opened up and it was getting, the body was dying. So what happened is that's how important the show is to me. I don't call all the time, but I was trying to get some steps in on the steps, realizing I only run the bridge a few times for the year, and, you know, I got to get it together. And I see most of the people my age, they're creeping and crawling, some of them, and they had stroke and sugar and all these different things. So, you know, I have to stay, keep ahead. But I think Dr. Curling was speaking because I know Dr. Pinto's voice readily, right?
And Dr. Francis.
He was saying, yeah, Dr. Francis, yeah. He was saying that some men don't even know they have a prostate at 20 and 30 years. And I laughed because I actually had a friend who was close to 40, and he saw me running the steps one time when I was recovering from the surgery, and I told him what I was going through because I knew him from, he was a young man, and he asked me what the prostate was after. I told him I had prostate surgery, and I had to explain to him exactly that. So that is very, very possible. But sorry I'm calling so late, but I wanted to get this in from a patient's perspective. And you know, just a comment, I'm fascinated by the immune system, and I've been dwelling in it since the pandemic, and I wish doctors would be sincere and tell people how it really works and how intricate and how smart it is and the memory that it has. But I'll share this from a patient's perspective as it relates to TERFs, right, Dr. Pinto?
Yes.
I was taken aback, and maybe if you guys write a book, you could consult with patients. And, you know, I had a unique situation, right, Dr. Pinto, in which I was wearing the catheter and the suprapubic, right?
Yes, yes.
And so when I was wearing the suprapubic and I had the catheter, and I think one time after I was just wearing the supra, right? I realized that I wasn't urinating as much as when I was inserted with the catheter. And what frightened me, and I want everybody who can hear my voice to please listen, because this is for males. I was taken aback by a nurse who said that she didn't know that when inserted with the catheter, you still have the urge to urinate. And I was supposed to share this because I was thinking, I really should write a book on the BPH and the surgeries, et cetera, from a patient's perspective. And so what I was taking, but she said she didn't know that I started to urinate. And so sometimes when they insert a catheter, you will get the urge to urinate to the autonomic response, you could correct me, right? Or the involuntary muscle response, right?
Yes, so the reason why...
What I'm saying is...
Yeah.
And so what happens is, as I wear the catheter, you will still have the urge to urinate even though the fluid is going in the bag readily. And so you would see the overflow from the catheter because the diameter, as distended your urethra, right?
Yes.
And so the pee would come out on the sides, et cetera, et cetera. And so I was frightened by that because I my body is smarter than any doctor. Your body is smarter than any doctor. And so I was saying, yeah, but I have the urge to urinate. And she was surprised by that. And so she told me to take two pills and go sleep. So at the time, you know, I was having the blood clots, et cetera, et cetera. And I look at the potential danger in the following day if I was an ignoramus wearing in the pajamas. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
So I have to express myself for fellow humans because there's a lot of pain in there. Even as I sat on the table and you inserted me for the sort of suprapubic, the anesthetics didn't kick in as yet. But I realized it was a life-saving thing. You understand me? But there's a lot of experience in there that has to be learnt. You see what I'm saying?
Well, I'll put it from another perspective. When what you went through is something that we really nowhere in the world they do for the last 30 years because the monopolar TERP is an antiquated technology that really doesn't exist, even because of the fluids that we use can cause what we call hypotonic hyponatremia, where your sodium levels can go very low. So only PMH do you have equipment that really was only... valid in the 70s and the 80s. I'm very proud of myself that it maybe took 5 years, but I did all the letter writing in the world and protesting, and I got donated a bipolar TERP machine and a new laser machine for PMH. So at least we have the state of the art in terms of kidney stone surgery and prostate resection. I advocated for years to get a green light vaporization machine for a doctor's hospital. We now have that technology available. So there are 10 different ways that we can resect a prostate. A monopolar TERP that you have, really nowhere in the world they're doing that anymore. Even at PMH, that's something of the past. So in the technology that we have, we can get hemostasis very quickly. All of my prostate resections, everyone goes home right away. You don't need to be admitted. the hospital after the, it's a minimally invasive outpatient procedure. So things have grown by leaps and bounds in the last couple decades, and PMH took a while to catch up, but now we've caught up with the rest of the world.
I'm taking it that a prostate resection is doing something medically to make the prostate smaller?
So anytime you have an enlarged prostate, the first line of treatment is medical. And there are several classes of medication that can effectively, one is an alpha blocker, very commonly known as Flomax or Tamsulosin, or the other form is called Hytrin. It relaxes the bladder neck, it doesn't shrink the prostate, and helps facilitate the emptying of the bladder when you have a big obstructing prostate. It's not just the size of the prostate itself, it's also the anatomical architecture of the prostate. So some men have, a normal size prostate is 20, 25 grams. Some men have horrible symptoms where they can't even urinate or dribble and they have to be on a catheter, or they're going to go into renal failure for not emptying the bladder and only have a 40-gram prostate. Some men have a 120-gram prostate, but when you scope them, the outlet, the opening of the bladder is wide open. It's just because of the distribution of the tissue, and you might have a little bit more in the middle lobe that might cause it to be obstructive because it goes in, takes up some of the capacity of the bladder, or the lateral lobes might come in and touch and are called kissing and then become very obstructive. So it's a complex issue, but we have so many things that are available locally that we can minimally invasively resect the prostate. Any closing statements, Dr. Ian Fernando, other than you're going to be back again soon?
Well, just like to say that we need to make sure that we as men are aware of how much we have to pay attention to ourselves. We tend to grow up with this thing that we need to be rough and tough, and but you're better able to handle anything when you know of the dangers that lie in front of you. Some of these health dangers, like understanding what the prostate is and how it can actually become an impediment to the way you enjoy life, you need to start understanding that at an early age and putting in place some of these safeguards to make sure that you don't go down this really terrible road.
Any closing remarks, Dr. Francis?
Just be intentional about your health.
So I would like to start by, I like to stress, we are not advocating sweethearts, but we are advocating 21 ejaculations a month to reduce your chance of prostate cancer by as much as 25%. Education is the most powerful weapon, which can always be used to change the world. So it's important to stress education. So have a good evening, Bahamas, and good night.
Good night. It's time to take control. Get some help from the urologist.
You will find he'll help you solve your problems on 96.9.